Hello, welcome. Wow, what a crowd. Hi, everyone. Thank you all for coming. My name is Deborah Becker. I work for WBUR here in Boston. I'm a journalist and a host here, and we have a terrific panel of authors today. I'd like to take credit for dreaming up this panel, but I can't. So it was very smartly organized, and there are a lot of common themes and some very unique stories here. Women's stories that really haven't been told before, and the biographies are fascinating, the research process is fascinating, and some of these things that these women have uncovered are things that were never known before. So it's going to be a great discussion. So thank you for coming. I'm going to tell you who each of our authors are, and each of them will talk for a couple of minutes about their stories and why they chose these women to write biographies of, and why these stories really haven't been told before. So we'll give them a little time. Then we're going to open it up for questions from you, because we do have, unfortunately, a short amount of time today. And after our talk, the authors will be available to sign their books right across the hall. Okay? So first we have Eve LaPlante, and the title of her book is Marmee and Louisa, The Untold Story of Louisa May Alcott and Her Mother. It's a terrific book about the writings of Abigail Alcott and the relationship with her daughter, Louisa May. We also have Megan Marshall with us. She wrote about Margaret Fuller, the journalist Margaret Fuller. It's a terrific story of a very independent woman, a story near and dear to my heart. She was actually the first female foreign correspondent, and she's got a great story as well. And at the end, we have Carla Kaplan, and the title of her book is Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And I was telling Carla before we started that I had never heard the term Miss Anne, really, until her book, and she said that's actually quite common, and she'll explain why. And Carla said something in her book that was really interesting. She said the story of the women in her book is really a story of women trying to belong when they were told that they didn't. And I think that that's the story, or the common theme, in all of these stories. So sit back and listen. It's going to be a great conversation, and we're going to start in chronological order. So Eve, I'm going to let you start.
Thank you so much, Deb. I was educated in the 60s, or I was a child in the 60s, when girls still took home economics, and boys took carpentry or woodworking or something like that. And late in my grammar school years, that was abolished. And by the time I went to high school in the 70s, these things were gone, and there was Title IX, and girls could run a mile in high school track, et cetera, et cetera. I thought as a teenager and a young adult that we were done with gender issues. And I was very naive. So when I started out as a writer, I wasn't thinking about women or gender or anything like that. And it really wasn't until in my 40s I wrote a book about Anne Hutchinson, whom I came to just because my great aunt Charlotte had talked to me about her, and probably Aunt Charlotte was much more of a feminist than I was at the time, and so I learned in writing this book about Anne Hutchinson, American Jezebel, that gender was fundamental not only to her story as an early colonial heretic, but also to the American story, and that from the very beginning in the creation of our country, that women had a private role and men had a public role, and there were these two spheres, and women were not expected to have a public voice. They were not allowed to teach in public. And that was sort of an education for me, and it became a very big theme in American Jezebel. Then I went on to write about a Salem witch judge who's a man, and there was a lot more documentation of him. He was a Puritan man, so we have his diaries and lots of letters and other information, and even portraits. We don't have portraits of the women. But it turned out that this guy, the Salem witch judge, was the first feminist writer in American history, and in 1725 he published a feminist tract, of which the only copy extant in the world is the rough draft at Mass Hist. So I begged my editor to let me publish that essay, Talitha Kumi, in the back of that biography. So I felt like I was sort of doing a job for future scholars, that we could now see what did a former Salem witch judge say about gender in 1725. And then finally I came to the Alcott women, and I mean, obviously gender is a tremendous piece of that story, but the discovery there was that the papers of Abigail Mayalka, Louise's mother, you know, this woman that we supposedly all know so well from Little Women, hadn't all been burned. And everyone always said, there's nothing there. I was told that so many times as I was researching Marmion Louisa, there's nothing there. And hundreds and hundreds of Abigail's papers are in university archives, most of them at Harvard, other archives. And I drove to the town in western Maine where Abigail had lived briefly in 1848. And a man there had letters she had written to his great-great-great-grandmother, which he was preserving, and shared with me. And what happened out of that was another volume came in addition to Marmion Louisa, which is the papers. They're not certainly not complete, but a few hundred pages of Abigail's letters and journals. So while some were burned, there were all these papers of Abigail's that no one had really paid any attention to, and it was very easy for everyone to say they're all gone, so we don't have to look at them. And so I think for me, writing about women's history has been this challenge to find the documents, which both of my co-panelists also are, you know, great experts in this kind of research, living with the limitations of the documents. But then when you find something, whether it's a household object or a story in somebody else's diary 400 years ago, how you use that to get through to the real story of what the women were thinking and feeling.
Right, right. And we should say that they're relatives. They're your family, really. So you should say you're descendants of the Alcotts.
Well, that was how I ended up writing about Hutchinson, and that was what led to this interest in women's history.
Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, so, Megan.
Well, my story is a little bit different, although it has a similar origin myth in the women's movement of the 1970s. The book that I wrote before this, the Peabody Sisters, was about three women of the Transcendentalist movement. And my idea behind that was that everyone knew about Margaret Fuller, I thought, in the early 1980s when I started this project, the great heroine of Transcendentalism. And so we needed to know about other women of that movement. And that was what launched me on the Peabody Sisters, which took me 20 years to write because of the very thing that Eve is talking about, how scattered the papers were, how hard they were to find, how hard the handwriting was to decipher, and then to finally put together the story. So when I finished that book in 2005 and I started talking about the Peabody Sisters, I would speak to audiences like this, and I said, well, you know, I had to write about the Peabody Sisters to show that there were other women of Transcendentalism, Emerson and Thoreau, you know, besides Margaret Fuller. And I got these blank looks. Who was Margaret Fuller? So back to the drawing board. I had to write that story. Her life was so dramatic, and she, as I said, had been written about. It wasn't quite the excavation work as the Peabody Sisters or even some of the work that Eve and Carla has done. So what I decided to do was try to write a book that read as much as possible like a novel with everything still being true. People had kindly said that my Peabody Sisters read a bit like a novel, and I thought, why not just go for it, write a biography that is as much like a novel as possible. So in case some of you don't know who Margaret Fuller was, I have a short explanation of her life, and then I'm going to read just a short passage from the book that gives you a sense of that novelistic effort of mine. So I was asked a while ago to contribute to a blog that's called My Book, The Movie. So this is what I wrote in advocating a movie for Margaret Fuller. Margaret Fuller was born 30 years before the invention of photography, but she lived the most cinematic of lives. An intellectual prodigy and brilliant conversationalist, she talked her way into the genius cluster centered around Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau in mid-19th century New England. But the life of the mind wasn't enough for her. At 35, she took a job as front page columnist for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. The only woman in the newsroom, she sought out the seamy side of the great metropolis, visiting its prisons, mental asylums, and orphanages, interviewing their inmates. And she made these characters the centerpiece of her passionate advocacy journalism. After 2 years in New York, she persuaded Greeley to send her to Europe as a foreign correspondent, reaching France and Italy during the 1848 revolutions, where she befriended the important radicals of the time. She was the lone American journalist in Rome during the brutal 1849 siege, and she tended the wounded revolutionaries as a hospital nurse while carrying on an affair with a young soldier who became the father of her son, conceived out of wedlock and born in secret in a hill town outside of Rome. This is the movie part. It will all be filmed in Italy, I'm sure. When the short-lived Roman Republic collapsed, the three sailed for America only to be drowned in a shipwreck 300 yards offshore at Fire Island in a near hurricane. Margaret and her lover's bodies were never found. 2-year-old Nino washed to shore where the few surviving sailors buried him in a trunk in the sands. So that's the arc of the story. It sort of leaves out her great feminist book, Woman in the 19th Century, the conversations that she led for women, a kind of adult education consciousness-raising group in Boston that went on for 5 years in not far from here in Boston. Elizabeth Cady Stanton attended them. They really were a wellspring of feminism and the beginnings of the women's movement in the U.S., But I thought I'd just read a little passage. You know, a novel has to have characters, and I had to make Margaret Fuller into a character, which she distinctly was. But here she is as a teenager, and I think you'll get a flavor for her personality. This takes place in her family was quite well-to-do when she was a child. Her father, a politician, and he'd bought this huge Dana mansion on Dana Hill and in Cambridge, and he was hoping to get a job as an ambassador from John Quincy Adams, the new president, and he threw this big ball. But John Quincy Adams was in mourning for his father who had just died and left before the dancing and never did come through with this ambassadorship for Timothy Fuller, Margaret's father. And Margaret herself had had a kind of disastrous party just a few years before when she moved from one school to another and hardly anyone came. Students were rather jealous of her intellect. And at any rate, so this picks up from there, painting Margaret as a teenager. If Timothy Fuller had hoped his older daughter would display herself as an appealing commodity on the marriage market that night, he was disappointed in this also. At least one young woman present found Margaret unchanged from the days of her catastrophic dancing party, describing her at the Adams Ball as a young girl of 16 with a very plain face, half-shut eyes, and hair curled all over her head. Margaret had laced herself too tightly by reason of stoutness, and she wore a badly cut, low-necked pink silk with white muslin over it. Her dancing was awkward, too, the result of being so nearsighted that she could hardly see her partner. Margaret was still a precocious half-child, half-adult, and anyone who chose to evaluate her in these days solely on the basis of manners and appearance was sure to find her lacking. She had not bothered to notice that the fashion for a full head of curls had given way to a mere fringe of ringlets around the face. Her heavy, honey-colored hair was difficult to manage anyway, even if it was her one point of pride. She had done her best job of corseting to show off her waist, but hers wasn't thin. Daring others to overlook her ungainly posture and ill-fitting clothes if they wished to know her, Margaret wasn't yet ready to admit that her appearance should matter. She longed not for Boston's elegant ballrooms, but, as she wrote to her teacher Susan Prescott, for the ancient feudal hall, maybe a place like this, where an assembled company might fall under the romance of the minstrel rather than the sway of a politician, and would venerate nature not as high-dressed and pampered, but as just risen from the bath. Words, not looks, were her stock in trade, but it remained to be seen what reward they would bring. Fortunately, there were many now who were drawn to Margaret's way of speaking and to her bookish, passionate nature. Despite Harvard's inaccessibility to women, the intellectual atmosphere of old Cambridge was congenial to members of both sexes. "There's a constant stimulus to improvement," one female contemporary wrote of Cambridge in the 1820s, "and even if you know today more than some others, they may sit up all night and put you down tomorrow." A born leader who was capable of directing parlor games with a wave of a handkerchief and always ahead of the rest in her studies, Margaret could hold her listeners in thrall. How did she glorify life to all, one friend recalled, inspired like many to superlatives when it came to describing Margaret's talk, All that was tame and common vanished away in the picturesque light thrown over the most familiar things by her rapid fancy, her brilliant wit, her sharp insight, her creative imagination, by the inexhaustible resources of her knowledge. While Margaret's sarcastic, supercilious teasing, her inclination to quiz, and her obvious disdain for mediocrity still made enemies of those who felt the heat of her scorn, her critic at the Adams Ball may have been one of these, she began to have admirers who plotted to gain her favor. Some girls tried imitating Margaret's half-shut eyes and habitual slouch in the apparent belief that mimicking her mannerisms would enable them to know as much Greek as she did. Mm-hmm. When others observed her trick of converting her long hooded cloak for use as a satchel to carry home the armloads of books she borrowed at the local subscription library, hoisting them over her shoulder for the trek back to Dana Hill, they begged their mothers to buy them hooded cloaks so they might do the same. Thanks.
Very good. And we should say Margaret Fuller was a role model for Louisa May
Alcott. Yes,
indeed. And you found writings of Abigail's about Margaret Fuller. Mm-hmm. How did she describe Margaret Fuller?
She adored her and felt very, I think she admired her. I think Margaret Fuller was able to do many of the things that, she was able to do both of the things that Abigail and Louisa failed to combine, which was work and love. She was able to have a family life, even though it was truncated by the tragedy of her death, and also to have this really fascinating career that at the time was mainly available only to men.
Only to men. Yeah, great stories. Mm. And Carla?
Well, like my co-panelists, Miss Anne in Harlem grew out of a previous book. And I had been editing the letters of the African-American woman writer Zora Neale Hurston, known to many of you for Their Eyes Were Watching God, right? Yeah, okay. And writing a cultural biography of her life, and I was trying to do research on Hurston's friends. She took great pride in having interracial friendships. They were symbolically very important to her, particularly her friendships with white women. And I kept finding, I couldn't find out any research on these white women. There were white women who were centrally involved in the Harlem Renaissance, not just there as tourists, not just taking the subway up to the Harlem cabarets for 2 hours and then skedaddling back downtown as fast as they could go, just what most of the white women would do. White women who were deeply involved in the cultural and political explosion that was the Harlem Renaissance, and there was almost nothing on them. And it was, I kept trying to read a book about the white women of Harlem to fill in that missing piece of the story. There were books on every other woman of the 1920s, right? Flappers, new women, suffragettes, nothing on these women. So this was a book that I finally realized the only way I was going to get to read it was to write it. It is called Miss Anne in Harlem. The phrase Miss Anne I use for two reasons. Miss Anne is a derisive term for any white woman. It's a term from the black community, comes from the South. As far as we can tell, it was developed by Southern domestic workers as a way, behind their backs, to refer to their white female employers. Southern domestic black workers could never afford to disrespect or disregard their white female employers to their faces, and they were stuck in their kitchens 14, 16, 17, and 18 hours a day. But behind their backs, they could dismiss them as Miss Anne. Some of you know the phrase Mr. Charlie or Mr. Eddie. Miss Anne is the counterpart. But, and so there's a long history of that derision and that sort of disregard. The women I write about in this group biography didn't want to be dismissed as Miss Anne. These were women who were trying against all odds to become insiders in the black Harlem Renaissance, even though they were white. And many of them became insiders in very complicated ways and through a set of really unlikely stratagems that included everything from hostessing to philanthropy to becoming wives and lovers and mothers and everything in between. The other reason I use the phrase Miss Anne is I came to learn that it is a phrase with instant recognition in black communities. You drop that phrase into any room full of black people and everybody laughs. And you drop that phrase into any room full of white people and everybody says, Miss what? Ms. Who? What are you talking about? And for me, until my book came out. Now, of course, you all know what it means. it was for me a really important reminder that even today we live in divided worlds, where a two-word phrase can be meaningful in a very complicated and multi-layered way for one community and meaningless to another community. And when the white women I write about, again, they were not just tourists in Harlem, these were women who put Black Harlem at the center of their lives, and they centered their lives on its renaissance. When these women crossed from a white world into a Black world, they were crossing a divide that was even bigger in some ways than our own. So they went into a world about which they knew very little, and about which everyone they encountered had enormous skepticism about them. They were also crossing into Black Harlem at a very particular historical moment, where Black Harlem was the national and indeed the international symbol of Black self-determination and Black self-definition. The reason that Harlem was the mecca for the nation was because of its symbolic stature as a place where Blacks could eschew white values, eschew white standards, and develop Black aesthetic and cultural practices. There's a wonderful expression that was current throughout the Harlem Renaissance to express of how important this place was symbolically and culturally. And it goes like this: I'd rather be a lamppost in Harlem than the governor of Georgia. I don't know how many of you feel that way about Boston. I'd rather be a lamppost in Boston. It doesn't quite work, right? Almost works. These women were crossing into Black Harlem at a moment where the symbolism of Harlem's Blackness was especially important. And as they did that, their whiteness loomed especially large, coming from both communities. These were women crossing race lines seen as completely uncrossable at the time. And they were women doing it at great cost, because once they did more than just go to the cabarets, they really couldn't go home again. White communities said to them, don't you do this. And if you do this, that's it for you. You cannot come home. And in the main, the Black community said to them, what are you doing here? What are you looking for? And my job as a biographer was to really try to answer that, to try to bring these women back as much as I possibly could and let them answer this question of what it was they were doing and whether the cost was worth it and why they did it. In their day, they are not women except for Nancy Cunard, who most of you, I think, have heard of from the Cunard Line shipping fortune. They are not women who have been famous, but in their day, they were very visible in Harlem, and they were often asked, what are you doing here, and why are you here? There was a Caribbean poet named Alfred Cruikshank who wrote a published poem to Nancy Cunard, and he asked her, this is a line from his poem, he wrote, what was it, madame, made you to enlist in our sad cause? You're all of heart and soul. And she wrote back to him, also in a published poem, her answer. And this was her answer. My friend, she wrote, maybe I was an African one time. And these were women who both longed for Blackness in many different ways, but also believed that identity was a matter of choice and affiliation and allegiance and desire, and that identity was not biology or blood. And what they did in their day was so unlikely. They essentially said, I'm volunteering for Blackness. Count me in. I'm one, too. To which the white community, as you can imagine, said, whoa, that's it for you. You're done. And the Black community said, what? You're volunteering for what? What are we supposed to do with you? It was not the way white tourist women came to Harlem, but there were about 60 of these women. In the book, I tell a group biography of six exemplary women who came into Harlem in a range of ways and who left me an archive. I wanted them to speak to you in their own voices, to tell why they were doing it. But there were more than six, and in the very end years of the 1920s and 30s, the journals, the NAACP's journal, The Crisis, and the Civic League's journal, The Opportunity, started turning over a page of each journal every month into a white forum for views on blackness. And white women started writing in from all over the country talking about how they felt about blackness, and many of those poems were attempts to volunteer. And I just want to read you a couple of lines from one of those poems. I've actually made it the frontispiece for the book because I found it so remarkable. You should also know that all the newspapers had a poet's page in that day. Can you imagine? Right? The Globe or the Times with a poet's page. So they all had a poet's page. But these poet's pages in the black newspapers started being poet's pages of white poems writing about race. And here's Edna Margaret Johnson. And yes, I checked. I went back to the census. She was a real white woman. She wrote in from Kansas. And this was her poem, and it's called A White Girl's Prayer. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but you'll get the idea. I writhe in self-contempt, O God. My Nordic flesh is but a curse. O God of life, remove this curse. The cords of shame are strangling me. Remorse is mine. I would atone for white superiority, sheer carnal pride of my own race. Tonight, on bended knees, I pray. Free me from my despised flesh and make me yellow, bronze, or black. And the women that I write about in this book, beginning with a Yankee school teacher who everyone has always thought was a black woman, because her depictions of white women are so scathing, she makes them monsters who go in a bloodthirsty way to lynchings with great delight. And ending with Nancy Cunard, who lost the entire Cunard shipping line fortune because she refused to renounce or hide her black lover, Henry Crowder. These are all stories of white women who went even further than Edna Margaret Johnson, who didn't just imagine becoming yellow, bronze, or black, but who left behind their whiteness to enter a black world, becoming insiders who would always also be outsiders.
I'd like to ask you, Carla, because I think the story is so fascinating, and you just mentioned it. How did you find out that that school teacher was, in fact, white?
So doing archival work is a combination of insanely nerdy doggedness. It's really just about being so stubborn that you won't leave until you find what you want, and luck. In the case of Lillian Wood, many, many years ago, I was editing her novel, Let My People Go, which has always been an important but minor novel in the African-American canon. And I was editing it for the second series of the Schomburg Library collection of African-American women's writing, because she was an African-American woman writer, right? And I was doing this work to try to find out a little more on Lillian Wood. And by doggedness, but also luck, I stumbled onto her unpublished autobiography, hidden in a Tennessee library. And she talked about feeling called to the black people. And she talked about giving her life to black people and leaving her Ohio world and leaving her white sisters, literal and figurative, and moving into a black school and essentially letting it be known throughout the world. She never corrected the record. It's what we call passive passing rather than active. And I had to call my friend Skip Gates and say, Skip, we got a problem. She was white. And so, of course, the book was pulled at the last minute. And she starts this story because she's an older generation, and the women I write about, who were flappers but who were also activists, did not have role models. They had almost no one to look to. Nobody was doing what they were doing. This is a period when we think about all the taboos are falling by the wayside in the 1920s. Not the race taboo. This is a line almost nobody is crossing, and they do not have models to look to. One of the only models that Miss Anne in Harlem, the women trying not to be Miss Anne in Harlem, trying to be more than Miss Anne, have to look to are the Yankee school teachers who went south to teach in the freedmen schools after emancipation. Most of those women never spent more than about 6 to 9 months. Lillian Wood spent 4.5 decades. So she's an important role model, and of course her passive passing was an important story.
Yeah, it's a great story. I just also would like to ask each of you briefly before we open it up to questions. So we're talking about women who completely defied social conventions for their time in a lot of ways. Women who had struggles like Abigail Alcott did and had to support her family at a time when women didn't do that. Margaret Fuller, of course, became a terrific journalist of her time when women didn't do that. All of these stories, what were the characteristics? Obviously, they were, you know, perseverant. They were sometimes arrogant. They were intelligent. They were talented. But what were the traits and the characteristics that allowed some of these women to go outside of the box, to think outside of the box, before there even was that term of thinking outside of the box? What do you think?
I think in many cases there is either rarely a father, more commonly an older brother, at least in the Yankee community that Abigail May came from, somebody who mentored his younger sister. And in Abigail's case, that was her older brother who had the education that she wished she could have had just by virtue of growing up in a comfortable middle class, not wealthy. They were friends of actually cousins of the lawyers for the Cunard family, but they weren't the Cunards. But, you know, one of the cousins was mayor of Boston, another one was president of Harvard. This boy grew up and he went to Chauncey Hall and then he went to Harvard and then he went to Harvard Divinity School, and by the time he was 22, he had a pulpit. So you want a voice? That's great. You got a voice. His sister desperately sought an education, and her older brother helped her get it. And you see this again and again with the women of this period, that there was somebody mentoring them and helping them, besides just the innate determination, stubbornness, pride, anger, resentment at their second-class status. I think that's one thing, and I just wanted to mention in terms of what Carla was saying that there is this long strand in American history of identification between women and blacks, male and female, and that at the time many of these people were going into Harlem. I don't know how early your book goes, but women didn't have the vote until 1920, and so a lot of the late 19th century feminists were sort of working to get the same privilege that black men had been given with emancipation. And the abolition movement is another interesting story, that women were kept out of the abolition movement until the men running it in the 1830s figured out that the women were really good at public speaking, and that was the way they got their message out. So because of people like the Grimke sisters, the men allowed them in. But you know what happened? The abolition movement split, and half the men split off because they refused to be in an organization where women could speak in public. So in 1839, we have the split, and there are now two abolition movements in New England. So you see these links between black history and women's history, where they're pushing against each other, but there's also this alliance as well, and they're working together.
Right, that's fascinating.
Yeah. I think Eve's point about the education is really important, particularly in Margaret Fuller's case. Her father, she was the oldest of ultimately six children, or seven, and then the next child was a daughter again who died as a child. So she was the sort of victim there for his educational efforts, and her precocity as a student has a lot to do with her father, a lawyer, you know, schooling her, teaching her to stand up and speak, to debate with him. But this led, in her case, and I think in a number of women of that, you know, of the long 19th century, as we call it, to a kind of alienation from her gender, which in Margaret Fuller's case fed her feminism. So there came a point where she didn't want to be, you know, a woman with the mind of a man. In fact, that's a big point she makes in the a woman in the 19th century. Let it not be said that a woman of great intelligence has the mind of a man. And similarly, she wanted men to be freed from whatever constraints they had. She said, there's no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman, in a very, you know, insightful, foresightful a treatise that I think was never really matched until Simone de Beauvoir was writing in the 1950s. But another point that you mentioned, Deborah, about the finances, the passage that I read to you from Margaret Fuller's adolescence, she had a quite prosperous family life as a child, but her father died when she was 25, and in fact the family fortunes had declined substantially by then, so she was also in the position of having to support her younger brothers, see that they got through college if they could, And I think that being thrown to her own devices may have provoked her to do the writing, to do the teaching, that she needed to make some money, and sent her out into the world in a way that she perhaps might not have had she been able to sort of stay home and be just, you know, perhaps a maiden aunt in the household. So I think finances were often a strong motivator as well. And she was, you know, the thing about her that I was sort of astounded by, at age 15, before all this, you know, finances falling apart, she said, "I am determined on distinction." She was just full of ambition from that early age. And when she turned out to be someone who had to teach school, she wasn't going to just be a school mom. She ran these conversations, and she charged a pretty penny for those tickets, so that she, you know, if you figured it out by comparing to Ralph Waldo Emerson, her great friend's lecture fees, she was earning per hour about the same as he was. Which I think is quite remarkable. And she worked actually for Bronson Alcott for a few months, found out she wasn't going to get paid, and quit that job. But the next job she took, she asked for a really high salary, pretty much the equivalent of a teaching job in Providence, the equivalent of a professor's salary at Harvard, which was not high, but it wasn't, you know, the school marm.
Right, right. So what would you say, Kyla?
I think the question of what makes anybody step outside the box at cost is a really interesting and a complicated question. In the case of the women I focus on in this book, the ones whose stories I tell at length, every one of them wanted to make a mark. Every one of them felt determined to be known for doing something and felt constrained by gender in one way or another, felt that she was being raised to have dinner parties and play whist, and what she wanted to do was become famous for something. And all of them felt constrained by their family backgrounds as well as by gender. When they moved into Black Harlem and chose that as the sphere for their activity, they also freed themselves from being told what to do by anybody. Because who was going to tell one of these lone white women in Harlem how she should live or act or dress or speak or who she should associate? Nobody. Right? Nobody was going to tell her what to do. So it was a sphere of great isolation, but also of freedom. All of the women that I focus on were women who had a really high tolerance for isolation. In fact, many of them sought it. What many of them sought was uniqueness, and it made them hard to write about as a group because they tended to avoid each other in Harlem. Even though there were 50 or 60 of them, when they were all at the same interracial benefits, they did not share a table or a podium, because the cost of what they were doing was high, but one of the benefits was specialness, was uniqueness. So the last thing they wanted to do was appear with others like them and forfeit that. So they would tend not only not to sit together, but to kind of do this and not want to talk to one another. They were also women who had both a kind of naivete mixed with a very canny sense of how to push the edges of what was happening in their cultural moment. And I think they needed both at once. So these were women who came into Black Harlem challenging the current racial ideology of the time, which was actually all over the place. Most of Harlem was very much committed to a position we now call social construction, an idea that there's no essence to racial identity. It's not in the blood. It's not in biology. But what fueled the Harlem Renaissance was a celebration of blackness that certainly sounded most of the time pretty essentialist, pretty, you know, a notion that it was immutable and was always there. And these were women, when they said, okay, me too, I'm one, sign me up, I volunteer, they were both being naive, because of course that's not what Harlem meant, didn't mean them, but they were also being very canny because they knew they were pushing the boundaries of what was considered possible at the time. And somehow they were all able to inhabit both positions simultaneously. A kind of optimistic, almost childlike naivete, I belong here, and a very canny, sophisticated, what do you mean I don't belong here, on what grounds don't I, that was really both a nuisance during the Harlem Renaissance, but also made them major contributors to a developing racial ideology that we inherit today. And we inherit it full of contradictions, which we live out on a daily basis, but we inherit it today, and it allowed them to contribute.
Okay. I'd like to open it up for questions because I think if you have questions, we may run out of time. So, yes. Okay, okay.
I think we'll need it.
I can repeat it for you if you want. Oh, you got it.
Having worked on a curriculum on Margaret Fuller on the 200th anniversary of her birth, I was fascinated by the level of detail you had about her time in Italy.
Oh,
like the baby and being born in the mountains. Can you say something about your research
well,
in Italy?
You know, I did go to Italy a couple of times. I went to the town Rieti where she gave birth to this child, and I saw the baptismal font where we now know that the baby was baptized. She, as I said, Margaret Fuller was quite a heroine in the 1970s and 80s, and there's been a lot of academic scholarship done on her, so I was able to work with that. All of her dispatches that she wrote for the Tribune from Italy and from Europe are in print and easily found and notated. So I was able to sort of move one step beyond that. I could use the material that she'd written and, for example, there are poems that she quoted in these dispatches without naming, you know, who the poet was. But now that there are the edited volumes, I could look at this poem and see that she was, in fact, describing a night she'd spent with her lover in the hillside, which wasn't particularly evident in anything else she'd said, but it was sort of a coded message. That's what I began to see in these dispatches, these very public writings. There's, you know, you learn that she can't eat very much during this period when she's pregnant, and then, you know, her hopes are swelling, and then, you know, it's just all so pregnant with meaning, I guess we could say. And then, you know, the other thing is that her letters, unlike for the Peabody sisters, the letters were all in the archives, handwritten, but Margaret Fuller's are in these wonderful six volumes, and I was able to sort of put together certain things that I think other biographers had not before, so that when she's leaving her baby in Rieti, so she could go back to Rome and cover this revolution. There's this one particularly moving moment. She writes to Giovanni when she goes back to see the child that she was so relieved after several months that this infant recognized her and nestled into her arms. But then a few months later, when she finally is in the middle of this sort of catastrophe of the fall of the Roman Republic, she finally writes to a friend in New England, Carrie Sturgis, telling about the baby. And she tells the same story that when she went back to the baby, yes, he nestled into her arms, but looked at her as if to say, how could you leave me? Mm-hmm. And to see the difference between the account to her husband and the account to her friend, she had not wanted to tell Giovanni that it was quite so heartbreaking as that. She probably hadn't even wanted to think to herself, knowing she had to leave the baby again, how painful that was, but that she could tell her dear friend in New England.
Okay, another question. Yes.
I'm really fascinated about the women who made this extreme choice of moving into the black community when they were white and perhaps privileged. And I know it was a time of growing sexual freedom, but to what extent, in your opinion, did their crossing this line represent a vote for their own sexual emancipation?
There was an extent, did everybody hear the question, to what extent was that crossing connected to sexual emancipation and to the new sexual freedoms associated with the New Woman movement of the 1920s? To a certain extent, every white woman's crossing into Black Harlem was sexualized by the press. You have to remember, this is a period in which blackness is understood as a pollutant and as a contagion. White men are being encouraged to take small medicinal doses of blackness to revitalize themselves. That's where the cabaret movement comes from and the Harlem Vogue. Modernity is seen as washed out, as dried out, as lacking in energy and vitality. And if white men take little medicinal doses of blackness, they'll revitalize. White women are warned the opposite, that if they expose themselves to blackness, they will darken. And it was always sexualized, connected to the nation's one drop rule. And it's not hard to go from one kind of drop to another. So racial ideas were always resonating with sexual ideas. And if I can just tell a super brief story, Mary White Ovington, matronly woman. This is a story of two generations of women in her 70s, born in Brooklyn Heights, somebody who led a completely celibate life, believed the only way she could do good work in Black Harlem was to draw no attention to herself. She was the white founder of the NAACP. Let me repeat that. There's a factoid you can have for free. White founder, if you didn't know this, of the NAACP. And the press was so intent on sexualizing any woman who made this choice, and they couldn't sexualize Mary White Ovington. She looked like everybody's grandmother. She was completely matronly. So what they said about her in the mainstream white press was that she was hosting interracial conversations to procure black men for young white women. So this was the extent to which every crossing of any of these women, for whatever cultural or political reasons, was immediately sexualized. Some women embraced that. Nancy Cunard said, fine, then I'm a sexual icon. Ooh, good for me. And some women, like Mary White Ovington, always chafed that they could not get out from under that. So it's a very big piece of the story.
Another question.
Oh, here's one in the front.
I'm also intrigued by the idea of white women in Harlem, and I'm curious now in 2013 in your own research, you were describing or referencing that there are still tremendous divisions in our world right now, how that research process worked for you as a white woman researching white women in Harlem.
I don't know if everyone could hear that, but it was sort of how did that work for me in 2013 as a white woman, assuming I am white, right? But it's a good guess. Kaplan, it's a known name, right? I have to say that I wouldn't have done this book without two factors. I wouldn't have done this book if I hadn't also edited Zora Neale Hurston's letters and done a cultural biography of her life and worked on bringing back Nella Larsen's writing. So I had a long time of being part of the recovery work of bringing black African-American writing, which, let me say, let's tell the one missing piece. Let's tell the piece that's missing about the white women. I don't think I'd have said that 25 years ago. I don't think it would have been the time to do it. But I also have to admit, I probably wouldn't have done this book if I didn't have almost a 30-year history as a white scholar in black studies. I'm by no means the only one. There is a phenomenon of white, mostly Jewish scholars in black studies. I'm one of them. I think my 30 years of being in that position gave me a certain insight into being an insider who will always be an outsider, being part of a community that I'm told I'm not, a natural member of. And I think it gave me some insight into the costs of that and also the particular joys of it. This is not a book about me. I swear there's not a word about me in it. I promise. But my own experience was brought to bear on understanding what it might have been like for these women. So,
okay, I think we have time for one more, maybe. Yep.
I'm curious, what brought you into that area of research 30 years ago?
Me.
What brought you into that area of research 30 years ago?
Zora Neale Hurston. Simple answer. The question was, what brought me into that area of research? It was Zora Neale Hurston. As a graduate student, I was exposed to Their Eyes Were Watching God, a novel that, for those of you who don't know it, takes the oldest form of literary expression we have, which is the quest narrative, a hero who goes off on a quest. And it makes the quester a 16-year-old unknown black woman, and what she's in quest of is an orgasm. It's unbelievable in 1930. No, it really is. The pear tree is frothing with delight. Go take a look. But she's in, it was an amazing thing for Hurston to do at the time. Unbelievably audacious. Hurston's word was always bodacious for what that was. And I was hooked from that moment on. I do think that many Jewish scholars come into African-American studies with an understanding of a certain kind of oppression, but wanting to look at it in a different sphere and in a different history. But it was Hurston who brought me in. And then it was my own sense that the only way I was going to get to stay in was to do insane amounts of research. So it just spoke to the nerd in me who wanted to have to read more than there was out there to read. I thought, oh, good, now I have to research forever. So.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Yes. Fruitlands? The question is to Eve.
Fruitlands was the utopian experiment in 1843 in Harvard, Mass, of Bronson's, and the family all went, and that was when Louisa and Anna's first journals that we have were kept, and they were 10 and 11 at the time, and we have Abigail's journals from that period, perhaps expurgated somewhat, but there are some very revealing material in the journals that we do have that Abigail wrote at the time. This was really the bottom of her marriage, in a sense, and she actually leaves Bronson at the very end of the Fruitlands experiment, which only lasted 6 months. And I don't think people had really understood the import of her going with her four children to somewhere else to live before, and then why did she not leave Bronson? Well, from a modern perspective, you think she must have loved him, but in a 19th century way, I mean, she didn't have any legal right to her children or any property or any money that might have come to her through her parents or anything else. As a woman, legally, she couldn't have those things. So if she had left Bronson, she would have lost her four little girls. And her cousin, the Cunard line lawyer Samuel E. Sewell, was quickly changing Massachusetts divorce law at the time. So 20 or 30 years later, a woman could leave her husband and not lose her children and could inherit property. But in 1843, she couldn't. And she also, I think, had a sense of morality that you should not divorce. It was improper, but there were really fundamental legal reasons. But that's a very big scene, and I think in the life of the entire Alcott family, that was the shift where Abigail took over, and her four girls, who were very young still, also took over, and they all became the breadwinners. The girls, by the time they were 14, 15, 16, were teaching and scrubbing and sewing and cleaning and caring for people, which was to win the bread for the family.
Became the little women.
They did. Yeah. Or the big women.
Well, thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah.
Eve LaPlante, Megan Marshall, and Carla Kaplan, as I said, will be across the hall for a book signing. Thank you all for coming, and thanks to you guys. Thanks. That was great.
Thank you.